Welcome, everyone, to Bitcoin OpTech newsletter number 297 on Twitter Spaces. We're going to be recapping a few news items. First one is DSL for experimenting with contracts. We're going to be talking about the proposed updates to BIP2. We're going to also talk about some discussion about resetting and tweaking potentially testnet. And we have a Bitcoin Core PR review club where we're going to talk about 64-bit arithmetic and our usual sections on releases, release candidates, and notable code changes. I'm Mike. I'm a contributor at OpTech, and I'm also executive director at Brink, where we fund Bitcoin open source developers. Dave?
I'm Dave Harding. I'm co-author of the OpTech newsletter and co-author of the third edition of Mastering Bitcoin.
Kulpreet?
Hi, I'm Kulpreet. I'm essentially a contributor to Breakpool, but I keep getting distracted by other more fun things to do in Bitcoin.
Jameson?
Hi, I'm a co-founder and chief security officer at Casa, where we help people self-custody.
Chris?
Hi, I'm Chris Stewart, and I'm an independent Bitcoin developer.
Well, thank you all for joining us this week. We're going to go through the newsletter sequentially, so if you're following along, I've tweeted out a few highlights, but feel free to jump into the newsletter on bitcoinops.org 297, starting with the news section. DSL for experimenting with contracts. Kulpreet, you posted to the Delving Bitcoin forum about a DSL, which is a domain-specific language that you're working on for Bitcoin and scripting and maybe advanced contracts. Maybe, Kulpreet, you want to provide an overview of what a DSL is, and maybe we can jump into some of the details of what you're working on.
Sure, definitely. Well, DSL is, I mean, it's difficult to characterize what a domain-specific language is, but the way I see it is that it has, you know, first-order functions and commands specific to a certain domain. For example, in the case of the Bitcoin DSL, some of the commands are to build a transaction just by saying what the transaction should look like, or to extend the chain, to give a number of blocks. And you could even stretch that, you know, so for example, in the Bitcoin DSL, we expose all the JSON RPC commands as kind of first order commands in the DSL itself. So that's how I kind of classify a DSL, that the operations required in a certain domain are just first order kind of functions there. You can just directly call them as opposed to kind of jump through hoops to make an HTTP call, et cetera, et cetera. And in the Bitcoin DSL, it's interesting, right? So when I first got into Bitcoin, of course, there's the good old learn Bitcoin from command line tutorial that almost everybody goes through, or mastering Bitcoin and whatnot. But it's all kind of slow and clunky. You have to copy paste things. You have to kind of, you know, or write some Rust or C++ code to kind of get your hands dirty, or even just Python code. It becomes kind of, you kind of get lost in the weeds, and it takes a lot of persistence to stay you know, chasing what you want to learn in Bitcoin to kind of get somewhere. So I always had this itch that it would be nice to have a higher level, like domain-specific language, as I said, to be able to do at least the introductory parts of Bitcoin quick and easily, right? There should be, hey, this is what a transaction looks like, this is how you build it, and hide away all the complexities of SegWit version 0, SegWit 1, what is SegWit, what is not SegWit, just hide all of that away from users and let them see that if you write a condition, a locking condition, like, and build a transaction, then you can unlock it like this, and then so on and so forth, then you can make some certain assertions. Thankfully, the Bitcoin space has evolved so much that, you know, there's things like amazing things like descriptors and miniscript, which is cool, but it made writing the DSL a slightly bit harder. But sure, the fact that you have those tools makes it so much more easier to kind of write the rest of the stuff around them to be able to do things in Bitcoin, for example, to be able to write transactions. Now, one thing that made this project actually plausible and easier to do was that we were not concerned about you know, the security of the scripts generated. We were not concerned about the speed of it at which these would run. So if you really want to write production code, you should really go back to your Rust and C++ libraries and whatnot. This is just a tool to kind of play around and, to be able to communicate your ideas with others in a more crisp manner so that, you know, things are clear. Because if it's executable code, you know, there's fewer uncertainties around it. Anyway, I've spoken a bit. I don't know if you want me to continue.
We touched on DSLs, I think, in the past on this show. I think there was a DSL, Doppler, that was a lightning testing tool that was a specific domain-specific language for spinning up lightning node topologies. And that included on and off-chain payment activity. I'm not sure. There's another LNSIM tool. I'm not sure if there's a specific DSL for that. And then I know that Warnet has this idea of scenarios, and I'm not sure how they implement that. Are you familiar with any of those tools? And is there overlap there?
I actually looked at Doppler because I was curious if that would just suffice for what I wanted to do. However, it was really specific to, as you said, you know, spinning up and down lightning nodes and to be able to define a cluster of nodes, you know, in a script, and then it would just go fire it all off. But for example, you couldn't. What we are trying to do with Bitcoin DSL is to be more lower level so that. It's kind of conflicting, but you can write contracts in Bitcoin. For example, you can describe the ARC protocol using this, you know, whereas the Doppler tool I remember is really specific to spinning services up and down for Lightning Network. I don't know the third one that you mentioned. I haven't seen that, so I'll definitely be looking into that. So I think there are differences, I mean, huge, as to what we want to achieve in each of these. There's a few other kind of languages, which I think in some way Miniscript put an end to all of that in a way that, okay, there's a nice way to do it, which were largely just being able to write the script itself, like Bitcoin script itself, in some other ways. Say, for example, I don't remember the name of it, but it looked like JavaScript, and you would write contracts to it in it, and it would compile to script. Similarly, Sapio by Jeremy Rubin is a similar tool. It's like in Rust, and it gets compiled into Bitcoin contracts. But those are kind of just compiling down to script. Whereas what we want to do is be able to write transactions, right? And be able to say what are the locking and unlocking scripts, like scriptpub key and script sigs, in, again, a very high level tool like Miniscript or whatnot. And then be able to, one transaction is pending the other, and then, you know, the output of this one is spent by another transaction. All that can be kind of composed and written and described. It's kind of difficult to talk about it all without, you know, a visual there, but I hope people kind of follow what I'm trying to say here.
What do you think, Dave?
Well, I mean, I thank you for working on this. One of the things I think about when I looked at your code there is I think this is really, really useful for just developers communicating with other developers about how a smart contract protocol can work. You give the example of ARC. I remember reading the original description of ARC, and it just hurt my head. He was inventing new terms. He was describing this very novel thing. And it reminded me, like, looking at your DSL and thinking of ARC, of like how, a few hundred years ago, people used to describe algebraic equations using words. And then somebody had the idea of a notation, and we have this standardized notation now, and it makes it so much easier for us to just see the structure and understand how the thing works. Words were sufficient, you know, to get the point across, but having a quick and concise notation just makes this really easy. And so I'd like to see something like your DSL get adopted for people just describing. They want to post on Delving of a mailing list, and they say, I have a new protocol I've just invented, and they can just sketch it out, hopefully with a few lines of, you know, this sort of prototype language or pseudocode. And we see people doing that with like Miniscript and decryptors now. Like, you know, we used to write whole scripts on the mailing list, and now people will just use a very concise Miniscript or a descriptor to do it. And like I said, I think your language is a really good fit for this sort of prototyping community. And what I liked about it, an additional thing I liked about it, is that it is functional. It's not just pseudocode. It's actually code that can be run. So you can quickly sketch out your language, you know, I mean, your new contract protocol. You can quickly sketch it out, and then you can go in and use the code to fill in all the edge cases, and then you can start to develop your client against, you know, this very quickly written pseudocode, and just make sure you're hitting all the cases that you identified and this high level description. And I think that's just a nice, like, a boost to actually getting these protocols from the concept stage to the developer buy-in stage to the first client stage. And then also that pseudocode, that prototype language, that's still out there for new people to learn how it works. So I think this is great. Thank you so much for working on it.
I'm really delighted that the way you've kind of described it all, because this is what I really wanted to get across, that this is the point. Like, if on the mailing list we used to kind of, you know, to and fro the contract conditions and say, okay, what happens in this case? And everybody was inventing their own pseudo language, right? Primary motivation was also, like, in the past there was discussions of channel protocols, and it's all like, here's a pseudo language, this will be spending this thing, this will be spending this, and you're like lost as a late stage newcomer, right? So you've kind of really hit the nail on the head in terms of what my dream was to do with this language. I mean, also it kind of eliminates the case, like, okay, here is how I describe the protocol. It works. You can run it in a notebook, etc. And the other person on the receiving end on the mailing list can say, hey, but I've coded this condition where it fails. You know, that would be an ideal outcome too. But thanks, Dave. I really appreciate that you actually really got what I'm trying to do here. So thanks a lot.
Yeah, you mentioned the notebooks. In some of my experience in my past life, there was these web developer type tools that had like HTML, CSS, and JavaScript at a specific URL, and you could tweak it live there and sort of play it. I wonder if there'd be something similar where you could kind of share these URLs, which would sort of have the script loaded. And like you said, maybe in a notebook, if obviously there's a Bitcoin node behind some of this, which makes it a little bit more complicated, but that would be a cool way to share and collaborate, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that is a cool point, because this is exactly what I've been doing as well. Right now, if you kind of pull the repo and just go just lab, it basically starts a Docker instance, which runs a Rectus node inside it and opens a Jupyter notebook with a kernel that interprets this DSL. So you can just start working away. And my dream is also like, for some of the protocols that I'm personally interested in for the moment, at least, to have those notebooks ready so that if somebody pulls the repo, they can, you know, when they fire things up, some of the examples of the current popular protocols are already there, right? It's a big compendium. It's also a way for me to kind of make sure that the DSL has enough features to be really useful. For example, yesterday I was trying to do silent payments, right? And I realized there is no way I haven't exposed group operations, right, where you multiply a scalar and a point. So I kind of expose that through so that, you know, I can describe the silent payments protocol. So going back, sorry, I digressed there, but notebooks is definitely there now already. I was hoping to host them online somewhere, but that's just another production step. I don't want to take on another 3-4 days of my life doing that. But at the moment, at least you can pull it. And if you have Docker installed, you can just, you'll have a notebook running on your machine immediately, because the image is also on GitHub, so you don't have to build the image locally. Another thing is that, I'm just going to take another minute. But another idea is that within a notebook, right, you could have multiple versions. So, for example, you have the Bitcoin Core node running, so you have the standard features available. But nothing stops us from shipping images with different forks of Bitcoin, with different covenants enabled, etc. And so that those authors of those tools, just like in Zapier, right, they could demonstrate using the same DSL, but talking to a different fork of Bitcoin Core, that this is how you can do it, right? And all those images could be on GitHub too. So I think the possibilities are interesting. It's a question of, you know, getting enough sample contracts out there so that people find the utility of it and are happy to kind of spend some time trying to write things with the DSL. But who knows where that goes.
Is there any parting words for the audience, calls to action? You want people to play around with this, download and tweak it themselves, other calls to action?
Yeah, absolutely. I would love help with like trying to describe any other protocols that I haven't yet thought of to capture there, which is almost all of them. I've only done Lightning and Arc, and I'm currently doing silent payments. I would love if somebody wanted to have a go at being able to describe how Rune works. It's a very simple protocol, right? But it's just the DSL captures it, or anything like that. To download it, you just go to the GitHub, and README has all the instructions. And I promise it's not a big build time because Docker images are already built and on GitHub. So when you go run, it just everything just downloads once and you're done.
Kapreet, very cool. Thanks for joining us. You're welcome to stay on, but we understand if you have other things to do and you need to drop.
Thanks.
Next news item is titled Updating BIP2. Dave, we've had a bit of BIP meta discussion going on the last few weeks. I think we covered in the last few weeks choosing new BIP editors and some discussion around that that's gotten pretty lengthy on the mailing list. But now we're talking about a sort of a different discussion that spun off in relation to that about updating BIP2. How would you frame up what Tim's posted to the Bitcoin Dev mailing list here?
I think this is probably an opportune time. So when the BIP repository was started years ago by Amir Tikai, he created BIP1, which described how to create BIPs, how to modify BIPs, and what the roles and responsibilities were of the BIPs editor. Eventually, the BIP editor duties get passed on to Gregory Maxwell. And when Gregory Maxwell passed them on to Luke actually made an update of BIP1, creating BIP2. So now we're at a point of talking about choosing new BIP editors. It seems like this is the historic kind of time when we would look at the process and decide if we want to update it. And Tim had some ideas. Some other people had some ideas. The main one of which I think was possibly reducing the scope of discretion for BIP editors. Right now, BIP editors have a lot of responsibility, according to BIP2, for evaluating an idea. They have to evaluate it to see if it's a sound idea. And that's not really explained what that means. A lot of people, I think, who are commenting on this are of the idea that, you know, really the job of the BIP editors is to prevent the BIP repository from being overrun by spam. We don't want somebody going out there and creating 1,000 BIP proposals, all of which are just, you know, ChatGPT created text. But beyond that, as long as the idea seems at least tangentially related to Bitcoin, it's something that probably should be standardized. We should probably just let it be and give it a number and allow it to live in the BIPs repository and allow people, developers, and users to decide what they want to use. Beyond that, Tim also had some other comments. He doesn't like some of the licenses that are allowed for BIPs. When you write a BIP, you're allowed to choose which license you can issue it under. And there's a set of suggested licenses. I think they actually might be required if you choose from that set at this point. He suggested that some of those were not good for documentation. They were really designed for code, which is fine. And also, one of the things that was introduced in BIP2 that wasn't originally in BIP1 is that every BIP has in its headers now a field called comments URI, which is the place where people are encouraged to leave comments on a BIP describing why they think it's a good idea or why they're opposed to it, and also a summary, which is created by the BIP editor, of those comments. And this has been underused, and some BIP editors, I mean, some people who have created BIPs really don't like the summaries of their BIPs. I think one of the big examples is like, BIP 39 or whatever is unanimously discouraged for implementation. So seed words, I think a lot of people are confused by that, since it's such a widely used thing. But that's just basically it. I came at these ideas. There wasn't a lot of opposition on the mailing list to this. There wasn't a lot of discussion about it either. I think it probably is time for an update.
Great summary, Dave. We also noted at the end of this news item that in that related discussion about nominations of new BIP editors, that the deadline that some of the developers had outlined had been moved to Friday, April 19th, which is just over a week from now. I think the original proposal was to potentially get that done this past week. So there's still opportunity, I guess, to nominate and advocate for moderators to the BIPs repository. Anything else you'd add here, Dave?
Nope, that's it.
Next news item, discussion about resetting and modifying testnet. Jameson, what's going on with testnet?
More of the same, but also some new stuff. So as I outlined in my mailing list post, it's actually been 13 years since we've done a reset of the test network. And interestingly enough, the test network is actually on block height, like 2.5 million something. So the block reward is down around 0.014 testnet Bitcoin. Results of that are that you can't really get much testnet Bitcoin by mining it. And the sort of length of the blockchain, that height, is actually a result of a weird edge case that happens where every once in a while, it's actually like every 12% or so of difficulty resets, we hit this particular edge case that causes the mining difficulty of testnet to get permanently reset down to one, the lowest possible difficulty, which then kicks off this huge flood of blocks that get created. We're talking like dozens of blocks per second. You can easily see like 10,000 blocks added in the span of a few hours or a few days as the difficulty epochs get run through kind of like speed running all the way back to what the difficulty was before that permanent reset happened. Also, really the thing that led me to send this email and start discussing this is that testnet itself has been getting used a lot more, but getting used for some scammy stuff. And the result of that is that people like myself, people who have a bunch of testnet Bitcoin, we've been getting just hounded by people asking us for coins, and specifically by non-developers. Like, I have no problem handing out testnet coins to people who are actually building on Bitcoin, but I've been getting flooded because now there are people who are participating in these airdrop type things on testnet, and they're expecting to get real value out of that. And so they're a lot more desperate in order to get these testnet coins. And in fact, that has gone to the point now where there are actual markets where people are buying and selling the testnet coins. And I would say that one of the most fundamental principles of testnet is that it's not supposed to have any value, and that's supposed to help in the distribution of these coins freely amongst anyone who is interested in building. So this is really why I've floated this idea of doing a reset. And you know, if you've been reading along the discussion, it's kind of interesting because it's been so long since we've done a reset. I think some people are a bit more hesitant to push for that. And then I was basically saying, you know, if we're going to do a reset, why not fix this edge case bug as well? Technically, it would be possible to fix that bug without resetting testnet, but it's just sort of open questions around how much work do we want to put into doing this, and should we all just bundle it together? So I don't know. I would say most people seems to be generally in favor of doing these things, but there definitely was a bit of pushback and some people questioning whether or not a testnet 4 would be successful. You know, like, is there enough like economic value already kind of entrenched in testnet 3 that would prevent people from switching over to a new testnet? So interesting discussions. I'm hopeful that we can continue just making some progress on this because I'm just kind of annoyed at the current situation.
I had no idea the depths of what was going on testnet. That's actually pretty wild. Dave, what do you think about Jameson's mailing list post and what's going on in testnet 3?
Oh, I mean, I agree with Jameson that when testnet coins acquire an economic value, the only mechanism we have, the mechanism we've used historically, is to reset testnet. I think one of the most interesting counterpoints to resetting testnet on the thread came from Peter Todd, and his point, and Calvin Kim made a similar point, was that testnet, you know, in 13 years of people testing it and doing all sorts of weird things, it's just acquired a decent sized, you know, repertoire of just weird and interesting edge cases. And if you're writing wallet software, especially if you're writing consensus code, like you're working on an alternative node implementation, it's just really useful to be able to run your code against testnet. And if everybody were to abandon testnet, you know, the data would still be out there, but it just wouldn't be as accessible. And I don't know, maybe there's a wide variety of clients on testnet. I haven't actually gone out and tried to quantify that, but there could be a large variety of people running weird nodes and weird wallets on testnet that are going to do weird things when they interact with your code. And that's what that's one of the things you want from testing, is you want to be able to test against other people doing weird things. So I think that's like the only argument that resonates with me about not resetting testnet, is that we have this repository of weirdness and we maybe want to keep that. On the other hand, I mean, like, and then there's the difficulty reset bug that Jameson is talking about. Like, one of the reasons that exists, I mean, the reason that exists is because there was a concern that somebody would take mainnet miners and they would run up the difficulty on testnet really high and then stop mining and nobody else would be able to make progress. You know, if they stop mining right after a difficulty change, then it would take 2016 blocks of high difficulty mining to have testnet make any progress at all. And I think that's a concern. I haven't seen that adequately addressed in the thread for me. What are we going to do if that happens? So I think there's some open questions there, but again, I think the economic issue there, if people are valuing testnet coins, testnet reset is what we're supposed to do. Go ahead, Jameson.
Yeah, so, you know, there were a few different proposals around ways that we could tweak the call it this like the minimum difficulty rule. So this Blockstorm edge case is actually a combination of the fact that testnet has a special minimum difficulty rule whereby if 20 minutes go by without a block, you're allowed to temporarily mine a, you know, minimum difficulty of one block just in order to keep the network progressing. And that in and of itself is generally okay. The problem, however, is that the difficulty retargeting logic additionally, for both mainnet and testnet, for every network, it has an assumption in the difficulty retargeting logic where it only looks at the difficulty target of the last block before doing a retargeting recalculation, because it assumes that the difficulty has been the same for that entire mining epoch, or difficulty epoch. So basically what happens is if you hit one of those minimum difficulty rules on the block right before a retargeting happens, then it's like, oh, our difficulty was only one before, so we'll just go forward and recalculate off of that. So it would be possible to only fix the retargeting rule if you wanted, but actually Andrew Polstra had a suggestion. And I think that his suggestion was basically that we change the minimum difficulty rule so that it would have to be several hours in the future. So the reasoning for that is that it's actually possible, if you wanted to be malicious or adversarial, you could trigger that difficulty reset rule at any time. Right now, because the consensus rules for the timestamps and the block headers have a fair amount of leeway in them, and nodes will generally accept blocks with timestamps, I believe, up to 2 hours in the future from whatever the current clock time on your node is. So technically, I could tell my testnet node to create a difficulty one block and just claim that it did so 20 minutes in the future, and the rest of the network would accept it, and I could build off of that and kind of create this runaway testnet block generation if I wanted to. But if we changed that minimum difficulty rule so that it would have to be like 2 or 3 hours in the future, that would prevent that sort of gaming issue. And I think it would make it much less likely that we would hit the permanent reset issue.
Dave, you mentioned... Oh, go ahead, Dave. Go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to say, yeah. I think if I'm reading Andrew's proposal correctly, what it means is that there wouldn't automatically be a difficulty reset at 6 hours. You would just be able to mine a single lower difficulty block. He suggests raising the default difficulty, but let's ignore that for a while. That would mean that for 2016 blocks, if I understand his proposal correctly, you would have a 6 hour gap between each block. So instead of taking 2 weeks to mine 2016 blocks, it would take, 6 months, 8 months? And I think that might be too slow for testnet. Now, I could be misreading his proposal. I will reply on the mailing list and seek clarification. It's an interesting idea. I think this is just something that, if we're going to reset, it would be nice to address this at the same time. Both the block storm issue of blocks too fast, but also the problem of blocks too slow, and see if we can find a way. I've always thought that. Yeah, go ahead.
It's not perfect. He didn't give reasoning on why he chose 6 hours. I think anything more than 2 hours would be sufficient to prevent that sort of gaming. So I think you could easily go with like a 2 hour, 1 minute window or something like that, whatever is just beyond the threshold for gaming it. But yeah, well, you're kind of hitting on an issue that hasn't really been discussed, which is, what is the desired minimum wait time to get a confirmation on testnet? And this is also why I brought up the question of, well, do we even care about testnet anymore when we have Cygnet, which is much more reliable on the block times? And the consensus seemed to be that testnet is not really fully replaceable by Cygnet, that they offer different things.
I didn't say this on my mailing list, but I'm in the camp of just go with SafeNet, kill testnet. But you're right that most of the people who expressed an opinion did say they want testnet. I personally think testnet is really only interesting to miners at this point, now that we have SafeNet. But, you know, I'm fine with testnet living.
That was going to be my comment slash question as well. Dave, you mentioned this repository of weirdness on testnet. There's a default signet, but there's nothing to say that somebody can't, encapsulate this repository of weirdness, at least to the degree that it can be recreated on signet and have a bit more of a sort of chaotic signet going on. I don't know if anybody's working on something like that, and if it would address folks like Calvin's comments about wanting a bit more chaotic environment to test in.
Yeah, chaos monkey net.
If I could chime in here, I think creating an archive of these weird transactions somewhere would be independently valuable. Just thinking about it out loud, it seems like the hard things that maybe would to like kind of port over to say testnet 4 from a testnet 3 is like time lock stuff embedded in scripts, because otherwise with all of your weird scripts, it seems like you could just swap out the public keys and then just publish them on testnet 4 in the first couple thousand blocks. Another thing on just terms of value of testnet over signet, just in terms of alternative consensus implementations along with miners, they're just as like weird scenarios, again, with time, reorgs, things like that, that have value from the perspective of a separate consensus implementation that's just hard to replicate on Signet. Whereas if you're just strictly developing a standalone wallet application, I do think that point stands for why Signet is a standalone replacement for testnet.
Jameson, Chris, Dave, anything else to say before we move on in the newsletter? All right.
Nope. It'll just be interesting to see, how difficult it is to keep moving forward on this. You would think that something like testnet, which is supposed to be resettable and not supposed to come with any guarantees, would be easy for us to move forward on, but I think it's actually kind of interesting to sort of look at this issue almost through the ossification lens, and the fact that the test network has built up value in a variety of different ways.
Jameson, thanks for joining us. You're welcome to stay on. We understand if you need to drop. Next section from the newsletter is our monthly segment on a Bitcoin Core PR review club. This month, we highlighted a PR by Chris Stewart, who's joined us, titled Implement 64-Bit Arithmetic Opcodes in the Script Interpreter. Chris, we've had you on a couple times to talk about 64-bit arithmetic. This is obviously a bit deeper of a dive that the PR Review Club folks did, and I think you were the host of this. I'll open the floor to you to maybe opine on what you think is different, maybe recap the idea at a high level, and then we can get into any interesting technical things that came out of the review.
Yeah, so like high level motivation for the 64-bit arithmetic stuff is I would like to do math on Satoshi values in the script interpreter, and currently we don't have enough precision in the script interpreter to do that. Satoshi values can be up to 51 bits in value for, I think, the actual 21 million Bitcoin, if you were doing math on that. Whereas our numeric opcodes or arithmetic opcodes in the interpreter only supports 32-bit precision with an asterisk there. In certain cases, we've already kind of lifted that 32-bit cap, and that's for our time lock opcodes, like I was mentioning earlier. So those time lock opcodes are called opcheck sequence verify and opcheck lock time verify, and they require 5 bytes of precision to do that, just because of wall clock Unix time. So the data structure in Bitcoin Core that handles our numbers inside of the interpreter is called C script num. There's a nice parameter that we discussed in the Bitcoin Core Review Club called N default max dump size, I believe, off the top of my head, that allows you to specify how many bytes of precision you would like to have in the script interpreter. So when opcheck lock time verify and opcheck sequence verify were activated on the Bitcoin network in circa 2015, 2016, we already extended the precision a little bit then. What I would like to do is, again, get Tapleaf update verify activated in Bitcoin Core, and to get there, we need 64-bit arithmetic. So the things that kind of came out of the PR review club that I think are of note is, again, just highlighting the interoperability concerns between existing opcodes that we have in Bitcoin script interpreter, such as opsize, that take as input a value on the stack, and you know, do something with that value. In the case of opsize, it's you know, count how many bytes are on that value and then push it back onto the stack. However, if you look at the implementation in interpreter.cpp, there is hard-coded limits of what the maximum amount of bytes these opcodes can accept. So what we need to do is, we don't want to fragment the interpreter across, you know, 4 byte, things that allow 4 bytes as inputs and things that allow 8 bytes as inputs. We want to have this kind of like seamless interoperability between the two, you know, numeric systems that are out there. So for old consensus clients, we of course need to stick with the old 4 byte inputs. However, with new consensus soft forks, we want to potentially extend that, and thinking about how to, you know, best design the 64-bit soft fork to allow for further extensions to maybe say 256 bits in the future rather than just 64 bits is something that we kind of discussed during this Bitcoin Core PR Review Club. You know, I'd like to thank Gloria for allowing me to, you know, lead this, and got some great questions about it, specifically around the interoperability stuff. I'd encourage people to go read the review or the IRC chat logs on bitcoincore.reviews, I believe is the website. And I'm happy to answer any questions over, you know, Twitter DMs or elsewhere if you are interested in the subject.
All of the PR Review Club interactions are on IRC and are captured and logged, as Chris mentioned, at the bitcoincore.reviews website. For this particular PR, it's bitcoincore.reviews/29221. And there's also a bunch of back information that's provided before these PR Review Clubs are held, which may be interesting for listeners. And in addition to that, we linked in the newsletter to the work in progress BIP, as well as the discussion on the Delving Bitcoin forum on this same topic. Dave, what do you think about 64-bit arithmetic?
Well, I'm really thankful to Chris and everybody who participated in the review club for working on this. A very large number of the soft fork proposals that are floating around would benefit from 64-bit arithmetic operations. So this is just something that's going to be useful pretty much any direction we go, except for ossification. I'm just really thankful that people were working on this. And I, you know, the thread on this that Chris started on Delving Bitcoin, I think it's up to like 40 posts. So people were putting a lot of thought and discussion into this and trying to figure out the best way to do this. And I'm just really thankful for that high quality engineering on what is kind of, you know, you would think of as a really boring thing. But we need people to be working on the boring things and just making them great, or we're never going to get them in Bitcoin. So thank you, Chris, and thank you to everybody who participated in this PR Review Club.
Chris, Dave alluded to some of the potential future use cases and why 64-bit may be required. You mentioned representing Satoshi amounts. Maybe can you give us like the canonical, maybe join pool, coin pool type example for why you'd need 64 bits?
Yeah. So like if you're interested in like any sort of like broad covenant proposal, things with covenants generally have restrictions on the amount that you can withdraw from the output the covenant is encumbering. So for instance, you might want to have a rate limiting covenant that says you can only withdraw maybe 10 Bitcoin every 2016 blocks or something like that, every difficulty adjustment period. To do that inside, to be able to perform the arithmetic or the math to enforce that covenant in the script interpreter, you need to be able to push the amount of Satoshis that you are restricting for withdrawal onto that stack. And to be able to fully support the entire range of values that we can possibly have in the Bitcoin protocol, we need 64 bits of arithmetic. There's a lot of other proposals kind of lingering out there that would like to introduce cryptographic opcodes into the interpreter that would require, like, say, 256 bits worth of math. But let's take things slow. I agree with Dave's sentiment of this is something that a lot of people want to do across a broad proposal or a broad variety of soft forks. And this is kind of taking the common the commonalities between those proposals and trying to just separate it out and get this, into Bitcoin independent of whatever the ultimate proposal we end up with for covenants in Bitcoin. Try and take what is the commonalities between them all, get it activated so we can get one blocker out of the way. My quote, I think I've said to you, Mike, a bunch of times now, is you're going to eat an elephant, do it one bite at a time. And I think this is one of the smallest bites that we can take.
Chris, thanks for joining us to walk through this. And again, folks who are curious about the technicals here, jump into that Bitcoin Core PR review write-up. And thanks for joining us, Chris. You're welcome to stay on. Releases and release candidates. We have three this week. First one is HWI 3.0.0. And it sounds like the main or only change that went into this version, which required a version bump, was a change to the way the HWI is default scanning for emulators. There was an issue that was brought up. I think someone was using Sparrow Wallet, and they were unable to find hardware devices. And it turns out that HWI by default was looking at certain ports on the computer for emulation purposes by default. And because some other software was running at one of those ports, it actually screwed up that person's setup and they weren't able to connect their hardware device. And so this change turns off that default scanning for those different ports and actually solve the issue for this particular use case and potential issues in the future. So you have to explicitly turn on that emulation in the future. Dave, I sort of skipped ahead to HWI 729 there. Do you have an elaboration on that PR as well as this release?
Yeah, no, it's just like you said. It just happened that, like I said, the person was running something on a particular port that's often used by emulators, and HWI basically froze. So they couldn't use it, and I think it may have froze Sparrow Wallet for them too, because Sparrow Wallet was waiting for HWI to reply. So this just by default assumes you aren't running emulated hardware, and if you are, you just have to patch an extra flag. So it's a nice, clean bug fix.
Core Lightning 24.02.2, which is a maintenance release addressing an incompatibility between Core Lightning and LDK as part of the Gossip protocol. Dave, did you drill into that incompatibility at all?
Yeah, a little bit. Actually, I saw the LDK fixed it or addressed it on their side last week, and now Core Lightning is addressing it on their side, so hopefully everybody will be okay. It's just a case of there's a gossip sharing protocol between different nodes, and Core Lightning was kind of forcing it down LDK's throat. They were saying, oh, no, you have to take our gossip. And LDK was set up by default to not accept it, and this was causing disconnects between the nodes. So now LDK has changed their implementation, so they will accept the gossip from Core Lightning and just throw it away. That's their temporary fix. And Core Lightning is now looking at an update of the spec to allow LDK to tell them they don't want the gossip. So again, it's just a little issue, and it's been fixed on both sides now. So that's good.
You mentioned the change to the spec. It looks like Rusty has that open PR for the sort of the Bolt cleanup PR, and that includes some additional feature deprecation as a result of this discussion. Did I get that right?
That is correct.
Bitcoin Core 27.0 release candidate 1. We've talked about this the last couple of weeks. We were fortunate enough to have one of the authors of the suggested testing topics for 27.0 on a few weeks ago. I think that might have been 295. So if you want to jump into the details there, that is the best place to do it. Anything that you'd add here, Dave? Great. Moving to the notable code changes segment of the newsletter this week. I'll take the opportunity to solicit any questions or comments. You're free to comment in the tweet thread for this space, or you can request speaker access, and we'll try to get to you by the end of the show. Bitcoin Core 29.648, removing libconsensus after it was previously deprecated. And Dave, we covered this a little while ago. This was 288, it says in the newsletter. That seems pretty quick, or maybe you have a comment on when these changes will actually roll out to end users as opposed to just a few newsletters ago.
Correct. So when Bitcoin Core does this kind of weird thing that I haven't seen other open source projects do, which is when they start working on a new release, so they're ready to take all the changes they've made in the last 6 months and put them in a new release, they fork off that branch and then continue developing on the master branch. So any changes made in Bitcoin Core this week or the last few weeks, those aren't going to be in the upcoming version of Bitcoin Core, which is 27. They're going to be in 28. So this change is being made now in the master branch, but it's not going to affect anybody using Bitcoin Core for at least another 6 months if they keep to the regular release schedule. So this is not a sudden change. This is exactly what you would expect. They decided that they were going to deprecate it with an announcement in 27, and then they're actually going to remove it in 28. And again, one of the reasons this can move so quickly is because there's apparently nobody who uses it except for the Rust Bitcoin consensus library. And they don't use it a lot, and they're happy just pinning to an old version for now. So if anybody else is using it, if you're listening to this podcast, and it's really important to you, you still have plenty of time to reach out to the Bitcoin Core developers, and I encourage you to do so. You have a few months, and they can undeprecate it. It's just, you know, git revert. But if not, it's going to be removed. And going forward, the project is continuing to work on separating consensus code from other code in the project through the lib Bitcoin kernel project. That's different design than lib consensus. Hopefully it's a more maintainable design for the project, but it accomplishes much of the same thing, is isolating that critical consensus code, separating it from the less critical code in Bitcoin Core, so it's easy for reviewers to see when consensus code is being changed, and it's easy for other projects to extract that code out and use it if they want to be completely compliant with Bitcoin Core.
Bitcoin Core 29.130 adds two new RPC calls, one create wallet descriptor and the second one get HD keys. What do you think, Dave? Will you break these down for us?
Okay, well, these are both related. The headline one here is the create wallet descriptor. And basically, this is a way of upgrading an existing descriptor-based Bitcoin Core wallet. So when a new protocol like Taproot rolls out on the network, people with an old wallet who are using a previous type of address, for example, SegWit V0, base 32 addresses, they may want to switch to the new version. And to do that in a descriptor wallet, you have to create a new descriptor. So this RPC just allows a user to specify what they want in very easy to understand language. In this case, they just say, I want a base32 addresses. I want the new stuff. And the WAL will automatically create those descriptors and import them and start looking for them, looking for payments received to them. It'll allow you to start creating addresses to give to other people with that thing. This PR also includes a second new RPC, get HD keys. And this is for a case of descriptor wallets that include multiple HD keys already. So multiple BIP32 keys. If you already have several in your wallet and you're creating a new descriptor, you need a way to select between those. So this RPC gives you a way to do that. It allows you to list out the HD keys so that you can say, okay, I want base32 addresses for this particular set of keys. It also is gives you a way to get the private HD key. We don't recommend that. Taking that key out of the wallet and using it anywhere can be dangerous. But if you know what you're doing and you have some special use case for that, it's a powerful tool. Previously, you had to back up the wallet and extract the HD key from the wallet backup. So this is a way to do it entirely in an RPC. But yeah, the main thing here is create wallet descriptor, and it's just a way to upgrade your wallet to the newest, latest, and greatest thing.
The next five PRs here are all to the LND repository, and I'll bring on a special guest who has not introduced themselves yet. Joost, welcome. Maybe introduce yourselves for everybody.
Hey, hi guys. Hi all. So I've been working a lot on LND in the past. So these days I'm also working on different things, non-Bitcoin related stuff, but still working on small projects on the side. And this inbound fee project has been running for almost 2 years now, I think, since I've opened the PR. And it finally landed. So good opportunity to talk about it a bit here.
Well, thanks for joining us. Would you like Dave and I to take these first non-inbound routing fee PRs, or do you feel comfortable speaking to those?
No, yes, please. I haven't been following those very closely. Wouldn't be able to comment much there.
Sure. So the first two PRs to LND are associated. It's 8159 and 8160. And that adds experimental but off-by-default support for sending payments to blinded routes. 8159 was titled Preparatory Work for Forwarding Blinded Routes, and 8160 is Support Forwarding of Blinded Payments. And then we noted also the third of this trio of PRs to LND is Blinded Route Error Handling, which is still an open PR. Dave, you may have more to add to that.
Yeah, so blinded payments were added to the specification a few months ago. They're already supported by Core Lightning, and Eclair, and LDK. So LND is a little bit behind the curve on this, but they are catching up fast. And what blinded routes allow you to do is for the receiver of a payment, when they create their Bolt 11 invoice, they can append a blob to it that contains encrypted, onion encrypted routing information for the last few hops to their node. So they give you the path to an introductory node, and they send that to the sender. And now the sender never knows the node ID of the node receiving the payment. So this is really good for privacy. It's a really nice feature. Lightning Network still has other privacy issues, but this is closing one of the things, which is now you just don't need to know exactly who you're sending the payment to. You got an invoice, and the person that invoice, you know, is willing to accept your payment and hopefully deliver a service in return for it. But now you just don't need to know. So I'm happy to see LND work on this. And it looks like, you know, right now it's experimental, but you can use it right now. And there's a follow-up PR for testing. And hopefully it'll be in the next release or two.
We have a topic entry for Blinded Paths and some other names for it, Rendezvous Routing, Hidden Destinations. And I like to think of it as PO boxes on Lightning. Thanks for summarizing that, Dave. Next, LND PR 8515, updating multiple RPCs to accept the name of a coin selection strategy to be used by LND. And then we also link back to newsletter 292 for some additional information. In digging into this, there's three different configurations for coin selection. There's largest, random, and global config, which I think is sort of an ability to specify to use the default. Dave, what's LND trying to do here with allowing coin selection strategies to be input by to the RPCs?
Well, there's different coin selection strategies you might want to use for different network conditions. For example, largest is, I assume that means it's spending the highest value UTXO that you have. And that's great for conserving fees. It means you're adding a minimum number of inputs to your transaction. But what it ends up doing is it kind of grinds your UTXO set down to dust. Because as you use the largest ones, you just get smaller and smaller UTXOs. So you want to use a larger strategy when fees are really high to save money. But it will eventually cost you more money in the long term if that's the only strategy you use. Random is a very simple strategy. It just randomly adds UTXOs to your inputs. And this is kind of consolidating because it has an equal chance of choosing a large UTXO or a small UTXO. And so you'll start to build up larger UTXOs in your change outputs from using this strategy over time. So that's more suited to times when there's the fees are lower. And I assume eventually LND plans to add additional coin selection strategies, and possibly for that default strategy, they'll look at the network conditions and try to guess which strategy to use to optimize for the user's goals. Bitcoin Core already does this. We discussed that, I think, last week or 2 weeks ago when a coin selection strategy, a new one by Merch, was added to Bitcoin Core. And this is just how wallets, I think, are going to be designed in the future. They're going to have a variety of coin selection strategies, and they're going to have a heuristic for choosing between them to try to best match the current network conditions to reduce a user's fees both today and also in the long term. So this is just good progress, I think.
Next two LND PRs are by Yoast, 6703 and 6934, adding support for inbound routing fees. Yoast, I think this might be the largest PR-related write-up that we've had ever on the newsletter, so there must be something interesting going on here. Maybe you want to introduce the idea for us.
Okay, that's a great introduction. I guess we should start with reiterating that the billing model of routing nodes, that currently routing nodes receive a compensation for forwarding their payments. And the model that they use to calculate what the fee will be is only based on the destination of the payment, the next hop in the path. So it doesn't matter from which node the routing node received the payment, it's all equal. It can only set a fee based on the outgoing direction. And it has always been like that, at least since I joined 2017. It was already like that. I don't know if there's any more history. Probably the thinking was at that point, someone hands you an HCLC. It doesn't cost you anything. So the charging happens on the outbound side where the routing node is actually locking up their own capital. Seems to make sense, but still, there were routing node operators asking for the option to differentiate more, to differentiate also based on the direction from which the payment comes in. And what these two PRs do is that they add experimental support for this. So if you're running LND with those two PRs merged in, so that will be the next release of LND, 0.18, then you'll have the option to not only set the outbound fee for each channel, but in addition to that, for each channel, you can also set an inbound fee, and that inbound fee will be charged if a payment arrives through that channel.
Yoast, maybe walk through why a node operator would or would not do something like this?
Yes, this is just such a great question, because what I've noticed within myself and also with other Lightning devs is that there is a bit of a like a gap between like the experiences that you gain as a developer for the Lightning Network and the experiences that a routing node operator gains. Like they are in this game where they set their fees, where they are rebalancing, they do all kinds of things. And the exact dynamics there, they are not that easy to intuitively get as a developer. Like as a developer, it's just providing the base building blocks for them, and they just like optimize whatever way they think is best. So I've been struggling myself also a little bit with like coming up with examples, like why would this be useful? It seems there was a demand, like people asking for this, but then understanding the exact use cases and also in combination with, are these use cases actually going to benefit the network, yes or no? Like it's actually quite complicated. But one very simple scenario that I always keep in mind is the following. So suppose there is Alice, Bob, and Carol, and Alice and Carol are sending each other money through Bob. And this is perfectly balanced. And this is the ideal world for Bob because he has his two channels and traffic goes back and forth all the time. It could be millions of payments every day. And for every payment, he earns a fee. So his costs are very low and he could charge a low fee for that service. If the situation is that all the traffic is unidirectional, so let's say Alice always sends to Carol through Bob, what happens then is that at some point the channel between Alice and Bob will be depleted and Alice might close the channel and just open a new one. So over time, Alice might be like opening new channels over and over and just pushing the balance out to Bob. Bob with Carol also has a channel with a limited capacity. So Bob will also be forced to do this, to keep closing and reopening new channels. So the cost in this scenario for Bob is much higher. And this is how I think about this. If you're a routing node and there are peers that keep each other balanced and they don't cost you any like chain fees, you can use a low fee for forwarding their payments. But if there's another source that is much more single directional, then it is you cannot really differentiate. So at that point, you've got two options. Either you charge a higher fee for everyone to cover the scenario where you need to close and open new channels, or you just close the channel to peers that are not as much in line with your desired traffic shape. So with this change, what can routing node operators do with this? With this, they are able to distinguish between those two cases, and they can, across the board, lower their fees and or accept more peers than they might do currently, just because some of those peers might not match the desired traffic profile that they're looking for. And the end goal of all of this is, of course, to make Lightning cheaper.
Dave, I'm gonna turn the questioning over to you.
Okay. Well, I first want to apologize both to Yoast and to our readers. The reason this is a really long item in the merge summaries section is because I failed to cover it back when Yoast brought it up on the mailing list about 2 years ago. I went back to try to figure out what happened, and that would have been covered in newsletter number 207. And we actually covered a different routing fees discussion back then by the developer ZMN. And so I'm really apologetic here to everybody. We should have been covering this earlier. So two of the pieces of feedback when I was looking into this and writing up this summary, two of the pieces of feedback I saw from other developers were first, Bastian was concerned that this really isn't the right role for, say, Bob in this case, is deciding how much Alice should be paying to route through his node. He really felt there should be, as you said, as there is in the original protocol, like a clear separation of concerns here. And I was trying to think through his point, and this is not his point, this is my summary of it, but basically Bob can offset any, I'm sorry, Alice can offset any change Bob makes with this protocol. So if Bob decides to lower use the inbound routing fees to lower the cost of going, say, from Carol to Alice, Alice can raise her costs and actually capture more fees if she believes that she has the right strategy. So I think this only works if Bob is addressing somebody who's doing a poor job of managing their channel and doesn't believe in what they're doing. If the person believes in what they're doing, they can offset any change made by Bob. Is that correct? Is that how you view Bastian's concerns used? And am I summarizing that correctly?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I need to go back a little bit in time, like to those discussions, but because they were quite like heated at some point. I understand the point that he's making. Like, say, it's not up to you to decide who's going to send you an HTLC. But then I'm just wondering, like, what is then the solution for the problem I try to explain, where a routing node operator either needs to raise fees for everyone or just decline connection requests from certain nodes. And I wouldn't say those are nodes that are poorly managed, because it's just the case that there are nodes that are just sources of payments. So they are, by definition, unbalanced, but not necessarily poorly managed. Like, of course, in an ideal world where the whole economy is within the Lightning Network, everything might be balanced, but yeah, that's probably a long way off. So I would try to like avoid labeling those nodes as poorly managed.
Sure. Yeah, it seemed to me like the only solution he presented in the arguments that I saw, and again, I don't want to, you know, stand for his opinion here, just what I read, was just closing the channel. I do think that, you know, having another tool in the toolkit before closing a channel is probably a good idea. So I thought this was a good idea, but maybe I don't completely understand his concerns there. And the other developer feedback came from Matt Corallo, and he preferred a different mechanism for accomplishing the same things. So as I understand it, the way this PR to LND works is that you're sending out an extra field in the channel gossip message that says, hey, I'm going to be charging, or in the default case in the initial implementation, offering a refund on routing fees on the inbound side. And so now the spender, when they create their onion encrypted packets and they tell each hop how much to forward to the next hop, they just tell, you know, say Alice is forwarding to Bob, they tell Alice to forward less to Bob than would normally happen with non-inbound routing fees in this initial case where it's only going to be discounts. And Matt preferred a solution where instead of having the sender decide how much they're going to send, have the sender send the original amount that they would send, but have Alice and Bob negotiate with each other as peers a alternative, you know, inbound routing fee that would be applied at the point the HTLC was committed. And it seemed to me that the advantage of the approach that LND is taking now is that any nodes that adopt this, senders can adopt it. So it's kind of sender-driven, whereas the approach that Matt was taking would be peer-driven. So it would require your peers to update rather than the senders. The advantage of Matt's approach is that it wouldn't require a new gossip message. It wouldn't require advertising this. It wouldn't require tweaking it in a global setting. It could be changed by peers very quickly in a, you know, non-public way. So I felt like there was a good set of trade-offs there. And when we see trade-offs, like, there's not necessarily a right answer there. But I just thought that was an interesting difference of approaches. I didn't know if you wanted to comment on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely interesting alternative approach. I also have been looking into this quite a bit, up to the point to even prototyping it in LND just to see how things work out. I think there was one functional difference difference though with the PRs and L&D that have been merged recently. And the difference is that if you just negotiate between the peers, the sender, like on a very small scale, doesn't really know whether the next peer is the exit, the final hop. So the final hop is also going to charge the inbound fee there. And in the L&D proposal currently, the final hop does not charge an inbound fee. And you wouldn't really be able to do this in Matt's proposal, because the penultimate node doesn't really know that the next one is the final one for privacy reasons. So there's like a functional difference. But other than that, I think different trade-offs indeed, sort of aiming for the same thing. But I felt that it did get a little bit like messy with like two nodes negotiating this like local extra fee that the sender part of that pair of nodes then needs to like work into the advertised fee into the advert outbound fee. But it's definitely true that for that, senders don't need to do anything, and the peers need to upgrade, whereas in this proposal, the senders need to upgrade.
1 second, we're adding Dave back here. Sorry, Dave, I think you're back.
Thank you for that explanation. And one of the things I would add there as a note is that I think it's possible to do both approaches. You know, if uses on the L&D side takes off and the other developers decide that they would prefer to go with Matt's peer-to-peer negotiated inbound fees, it's possible to do that in parallel and ultimately to switch to it, or to continue using both sides in parallel. So I think this is just an interesting addition of features to the network, and we're basically just going to have to see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly it. It's difficult to predict like how this works into the current dynamics in the Lightning Network. So it's very like implemented in a very optional, also relatively safe way, like cases such as global negative fees, things like that are all not possible in the current implementation, just to make the delta as small as possible and still try to get this like practical feedback from routing nodes to see how this works for them.
Joost, thanks for joining us, and thanks for hanging on till we got to this portion of the newsletter. Anything else you'd say before we move on?
No, that's all. Thanks for covering this one.
Thanks, Joost. Rust Bitcoin 2652, which changes what public key is returned by the API when signing a Taproot input as part of processing a PSBT. Dave, from the quote you have in here, it sounds like people were expecting a different public key being returned, which is potentially technically incorrect, but now Rust Bitcoin has changed to returning that value within the API. Maybe, is that right? Or correct me where I'm wrong here.
I'm going to confess that I'm honestly a little confused what was happening before and what is happening now. So I'm just not going to comment on it. Sorry.
Okay. Well, if folks are curious, they can jump into this 2652 PR on the Rust Bitcoin repository, which is part of a bigger project, and there's a series of commentary there. So you're on your own for this one, guys. Sorry. Last PR is HWI 729, which we covered earlier in the segment on HWI 3.0.0 being released. So I don't think we need to rehash that here. I do not see any comments or requests for speaker access. So Dave, any parting words?
Thanks for reading and thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks to all our special guests this week. We had Chris Stewart on, we had Colpreet, we had Jameson and Joost, and thanks to my co-host this week, Dave Harding. See you all next week. Cheers.